with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, as Wisconsin marks Women's History Month, we'll talk to the first woman to serve as lieutenant governor of the state and look at the historic number of women in the state legislature. First, it's the week in Washington, where we learn more about some of the top stories in national politics. The Biden administration and the Democratic-controlled Congress are responding to a pair of deadly mass shootings and an ongoing situation with immigrant overcrowding at the southern border. Just today, President Biden announced that he's tapping Vice President Harris to be the point person for both addressing the immediate flow of migrants from other countries, as well as developing a strategy around longer-term root causes of this migration. And Biden and Democrats are trying to move forward with major policy goals, including infrastructure upgrades and other campaign promises around climate change and racial equity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see as some of the biggest infrastructure challenges the country is currently facing? What do you think the federal government can and or should do to help? And a big point of contention, how to pay for it all. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andy Duren covers Congress and American politics for the Wall Street Journal. Andy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with responses to the shootings now in two major American cities. What are we hearing from President Biden and what he's looking for from Congress in response?
So President Biden has called on Congress this week to pass two things. One is a universal background checks along the lines of legislation that has previously passed in the House, and then also to ban assault weapons, which was something that were banned for a while. Actually, when he was in the Senate, President Biden helped put that together in 1994, and then that ban actually expired after 10 years. But it's important to keep in mind that, you know, tragically, you know, with the, you know, the frequency of these shootings, Congress often, you know, turns to the gun issue, the gun control issue after, you know, these mass shootings or, a series of these mass shootings. And they have a conversation about some of these same topics, including background checks and possibly an assault weapon ban or, you know, implementing federal red flag laws and things like that. And so far in recent years, you know, that has not gone anywhere, has not produced legislation.
And we heard from Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer yesterday, who announced he's in the process of bringing forward a couple bills on the Senate floor, one of them related to crimes against Asian American and Pacific Islanders, another related to domestic terrorism. Again, these are things that have passed the House. Can you tell us about these bills and their chances in the Senate? Sounds like,
yeah.
Oh, there you are.
Sorry if I'm having connection issues.
Well, you're back. Go for it.
Sorry. So those, I think a lot of legislation coming from the House will have a difficult road in the Senate, both for two reasons. I mean, one is in some cases there are Democrats who don't support this legislation or who are skeptical of this legislation or who share some of the goals of the legislation, but not all of it. And then another is, the absence of Republican support or widespread Republican support for these measures. Some of the events of the last few weeks have added a lot of fresh energy to a conversation around getting rid of the filibuster in the Senate, which is basically the requirement that a piece of legislation has 60 votes in support of it to be able to move through the process, or that, you know, you can block a piece of legislation with 41 votes. So in a 50-50 Senate, that obviously means that Republicans still hold a lot of power. And so there has been this, you know, renewed conversation among Democrats in the Senate about whether they should get rid of that requirement and, you know, make it so that legislation like gun control and some of these other measures can advance just with 50 votes.
We are talking about some of the top stories in national politics this week. Andy Duren is with us from the Wall Street Journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. One of the next big issues that our guest has been reporting on involves infrastructure spending, calls from the Biden administration for a big investment over the next 10 years or so. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on that idea. Andy, I think if I have this right, there's not a formal plan at this point from the Biden administration. What kind of things do we know, though, that they're looking at?
So there's not a formal public plan, but there are some preliminary plans being prepared at the White House right now. Our understanding is that aides are bringing some proposals to the president this week, and that he and his top advisors will be kind of finalizing them before rolling them out to folks on Capitol Hill and possibly the public. And so the big things we know about those plans is, first of all, it's going to be roughly $3 trillion or more of new federal spending, and it's going to be split into kind of two broad buckets. The first bucket is going to be focused on infrastructure spending. So obviously things like, bridges and roads and, sewage systems, water distribution systems, dams and things like that. But then also, clean energy investments and the electricity grid and, just the totality of different infrastructure needs that are out there. So that will be the first package. And then the second package will be focused on kind of education measures and anti-poverty measures. So there are things like universal pre-K and tuition-free community college, but then also expanding or making permanent a few social welfare programs, some of which are quite recent. One of the big ones is, expanding or extending, a child tax credit, a new child tax credit that Democrats recently passed into law. So that's kind of the big, umbrella that is out there right now. It's still preliminary. And of course, it still has to go to lawmakers on Capitol Hill who, obviously we'll have a lot of input and a lot of opinions about what this package or packages should look like. But I do think in the coming days, in the coming weeks, we'll start to see quite a bit more information about the specifics of the plan and what we might see actually become law.
And that $3 trillion-ish number, I mean, you look at that stacked up against that $1.9 trillion recovery package. That was already a lot of money. But this $3 trillion, as I understand it, would be spread over, 10 years or so? Still a lot of money, but not this one big lump sum that we saw, like, in the emergency relief.
Right, yeah. I think it would be, especially for things like infrastructure projects, it would kind of go out the door over time. And for some measures, it would be extending a program that maybe costs, for example, $90 billion a year for 10 years. So that would be, for a total of $900 billion for the price tag. Another important part of this and another reason that it will differ from the $1.9 trillion plan is there will be a much more intense discussion about raising taxes as part of this effort or including other kind of revenue raising or cost saving measures as part of this plan. So some of the big things under consideration right now at the White House are things that, Joe Biden included, as part of his campaign proposals, things like raising the corporate tax rate or raising the capital gains tax rate for high earners or raising the top income, the top marginal tax rate for income tax rate for top earners and things like that. And so it's unlikely that those measures, even if, there were, several of these things that Biden campaigned on, it still might not be enough to cover the full cost of the package. But I think we will see possibly some pretty substantial kind of tax increases, especially for corporations and, high income individuals and families as part of the bill.
And now infrastructure is something that it seems like for years we've heard, oh, that's a topic that Obama could work with Republicans on or Trump could work with Democrats on. And now maybe Biden could work with Republicans on. What kind of prospects are there for bipartisan agreement, even on just, discrete parts of a proposal like this from the Biden administration?
I think that's a really open and important question right now at this stage in the discussions. I mean, as you said, we've heard this or we've seen this movie before where, Democrats say that they won't Democrats on an infrastructure plan. And they both say that infrastructure has always been something that Congress has been able to do on a bipartisan basis. And yet, as you mentioned, they haven't been able to do it, at least in recent years. So I think we will see a more concerted effort or a more concerted attempt to put together something along bipartisan lines, especially to start with. During the relief plan just a few months ago, there was a very brief beginning phase where Democrats and Republicans were courting each other before it became clear that Democrats were going to, try to move forward on their own. And so I think we will see in the coming weeks and months you know, Republicans and Democrats try to look at where they could come together specifically on, you know, really like rebuilding and repairing infrastructure and, you know, roads and bridges and rail lines and things of that nature. I think what will really complicate that or make things much more difficult is this question of tax increases. There is kind of a tricky situation where you have Republicans who are opposed to or worried about, you know, a lot of new, you know, deficit financed spending and, you know, adding to the nation's debt. But then at the same time, you know, Republicans are opposed to some of the tax increases that Democrats propose. And then Democrats are opposed to the tax increases that Republicans propose. And so I think if there is going to be a serious effort to try and pay for this, I think, you know, maybe Democrats and Republicans can, you know, agree that we should have, you know, a better functioning rail system in the United States, but they probably, it's less likely or might be more difficult for them to agree on, you know, raising the corporate tax rate to do that, or, you know, raising the gas tax to do that, or, you know, some combination of the two or whatever. And so, it will be a really interesting few weeks here as the Biden White House does put out, you know, a more specific outline and details of.
We're talking to Andy Duren, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. It's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Democrats and Republicans work together on infrastructure spending? Is there something you'd like them to focus on? Nuts and bolts, cars and rails, maybe climate change? 800-642-1234. Also coming up, we'll look at the situation on the U.S. southern border, the response from the Biden administration. What do you want to see from the Biden administration on border issues? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Wall Street Journal reporter Andy Duren, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on infrastructure spending. If you want to see some of it, lots of it, what you'd like to see maybe here in Wisconsin done with that kind of money, 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's bring on a caller now. Jim is with us in Hartford. Jim, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I don't think he should be spending any money. The last time when he was vice president to Obama, they did a big infrastructure package, and the money really was misappropriated. It didn't really do anything. It didn't really go anywhere. How do we trust that the money that they're going to generate is going to go for the things they say? And how effective really is it going to be? Is it worth that much debt? I just don't see it panning out like they think.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Jim, referring back to the post-Great Recession recovery spending. Andy, a lot of that did go into highways. There was criticism, though, into some of what it went into. I don't know. How do people in Washington talk about how to measure the effectiveness of this kind of spending?
I do think that will be, you know, important challenge for the Biden administration is how they, you know, do go about implementing all of this. But I do think that there is a difference in how folks are thinking about or approaching this infrastructure package in a way than they might have with previous infrastructure spending. And that's that, you know, the Biden administration really sees this infrastructure plan as being, you know, basically synonymous with their agenda on climate change. And so there will be, I think, a big way of in terms of how this will be described and talked about and what a lot of the measures will be aimed at energy efficiency and investing in clean energy resources and, you know, updating our infrastructure to be more, you know, the nation's infrastructure to be more resilient to climate change and things of that nature. In terms of monitoring and controlling how it all gets spent, I think there might be, you know, possibly depending on what the you know, economy looks like, you know, as the bill comes together and later this year, there could also be a change in emphasis in terms of, you know, what kind of time scale the money would be geared towards. You know, in some cases, I think for previous bills, there's been an emphasis on kind of shovel ready projects and things where you can get the money out the door quickly and into the economy. But and that can sometimes create problems in terms of implementation or complications in terms of implementation. But I think if, you know, some of the pressure is off in terms of the state of the economy and there is this kind of longer term goal with climate change, that they might have a different approach and might, you know, could be more deliberate and possibly use the money more wisely.
Thanks a lot for that call. Let's turn now, Andy, to another big issue facing the Biden administration, a big jump in the number of people crossing the Mexico-U.S. border, especially children, raising concerns about the space to house them while their asylum applications are being processed. What kind of things are we hearing from the Biden administration on that this week?
So obviously you saw today that Vice President Harris has been kind of tapped to take the lead on a few of these things. And there were, you know, officials, U.S. officials traveling in Mexico and the Northern Triangle countries later this week to meet with officials there about steps that can be taken in those countries to try and, you know, in the first place, you know, stop folks from leaving, and then also working with Mexico to try and, I guess, you know, regulate how people are coming to the United States. But I do think it is going to, you know, remain a huge challenge. I mean, the reasons that, you know, people do leave, you know, try and enter the United States often is a product of kind of systemic problems in their home countries. And so obviously that's, those aren't things you can necessarily change or address in a week. In terms of the folks who are, or the folks who are, coming into the United States, often the unaccompanied minors who are being housed in kind of U.S. facilities. I know the, you know, last week the administration was trying to take steps to, you know, increase the amount of shelter space, and then also removing some kind of distancing requirements that had put in place because of COVID to, you know, increase the capacity of some of the shelters. But I do think that, you know, both with obviously the number of people who are trying to, you know, come into the United States, and then with, you know, the extent to which Republicans really do see this as a political opportunity for them to, you know, attack the administration and draw what they see as a contrast between Republican immigration policies and Democratic immigration policies. I think this will continue to be, you know, a challenge for the administration.
Yeah, staying with the politics of it, I mean, you've got Republicans criticizing the Biden administration, saying they're, that the Biden's changes in policy have led to this increase in numbers. You've got people on the left saying, hey, wait, what about the humane treatment of these kids? We don't think you're doing enough. The press, meanwhile, saying it, rightly, that they are being barred from seeing some of these facilities. How big an issue, a political problem, is this for the Biden administration?
I think time will tell how big of an issue it will be. I mean, I think to your point, Republicans, again, they want to try and blame the Biden administration's policies as driving this. That, I mean, in their view, you know, tougher rhetoric on immigration and basically trying to discourage people from coming to the United States by saying they won't be able to live here or come in would, you know, help solve this problem. I think it will really depend, you know, how big of a problem this remains will one depend on, you know, just how many more people keep coming to the United States, and, you know, how well the Biden administration is able to kind of adapt to, you know, house the unaccompanied minors and pair them with, you know, foster or, you know, pair them with sponsors in the United States. But then also, I think will also depend on basically on what other events kind of pop up. You know, I think if we do start to see the administration put out a plan that includes, you know, a major hike in the corporate tax rate and, you know, an increase on the top marginal income tax rate for high earners and things like that, I think you could also start to see Republicans focus a little bit more on, you know, the proposed tax increases as something they see as a vulnerability, in addition to, you know, the situation at the border. So kind of where the political wind shift is always a little unpredictable. But in general, immigration is an issue that Republicans see as, you know, favorable to them, or one where they are kind of more popular than Democrats.
Talking to Andy Duren from The Wall Street Journal about some of the top stories in national politics. Martha in Menominee is with us, has an issue to bring up. Martha, hi.
Yeah, hey, Rob, thanks for doing this. You put out a call to the listeners to find out what the priorities for the Democrats in Wisconsin should be. And my suggestion is to put all their effort into defeating Ron Johnson should he choose to run. You know, he has said he's not made up his mind yet.
Martha, thanks a lot for the call. Andy, just in our last minute and a half or so, everything we've talked about is happening with the backdrop of a big midterm election. It seems like a long way away. And people focused on seats like this one currently held by Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. How's that affecting what we're seeing in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, I think Senator, obviously, Ron Johnson, Wisconsin, you know, that Senate seat, whether he's running for it or not, will be one of the most competitive ones this coming cycle. And, you know, Democrats see that as a big opportunity to, you know, pad their margin a little bit in the Senate, you know, especially given that, obviously, Joe Biden won Wisconsin in November. I do think that with all these pieces, all these issues we're talking about, whether it's immigration or gun control or infrastructure, it is interesting that, you know, Senator Johnson does not necessarily behave the way other senators in kind of similar situations typically do. You know, when usually you might expect a senator up for reelection in a swing state that was, you know, carried by a president of the opposite party, that they might have an incentive to, you know, visibly, you know, make appearances with the president of that party, or, you know, be a high profile supporter, or at least, you know, negotiator on something like an infrastructure package, or maybe even gun control, to try and kind of burnish their bipartisan credentials. But in Wisconsin, that is not, you know, so far, that is not kind of the path that Ron Johnson has taken, where he's obviously been a, you know, a prominent critic of Biden and members of his family, and in general is not someone who's out there. Like someone like Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, who, you know, tried to reach compromises on gun control. He's not out there, you know, engaging in that kind of negotiation with the White House.
And we'll leave it there. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Andy Duren from The Wall Street Journal joining us for our week in Washington. Coming up, a look at rising numbers of women in legislatures around the country. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, can be a challenge for kids and adults even in normal times. And the pandemic has brought some new challenges. A doctor joins the show to talk about ADHD and available treatments. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, for Women's History Month, we're talking with a politician who broke boundaries here in Wisconsin, the state's first woman to serve as Lieutenant Governor Margaret Farrow. Farrow served as lieutenant governor under then-Governor Scott McCallum from 2001 to 2003. That came after a long career in state and local politics. She joins us now to talk about her political career and her thoughts on the number of women in political office today. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for the former lieutenant governor about her career? And do you wonder why there aren't more women in politics, though we are seeing some record numbers in state and federal legislatures? That's 800-642-1234. As we mentioned, Margaret Farrow was lieutenant governor of Wisconsin and served in the state assembly and state senate for 15 years. She was also chair of the state women's council. Margaret Farrow, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Well, you've been on this network a lot over the years talking about politics. Let's talk about you a little bit. How did you first decide to make the entry into the political world?
Well, I'm glad you said political to an extent, except I would change that to government world. Mm. And sixth grade civics is where it all started for me. And I say that to the kids, especially when I talk to them and have throughout the years, because you have to be alert to what's going to turn you on and what's going to light your flame. And sixth grade civics made me aware of what government does and what I could do to be part of it. And it just went from there. And I got into local government because I found it so interesting. And I also knew I could handle it with raising five sons. And my husband was teaching at Milwaukee School of Engineering. And so it just worked out for us. And that's where I threw my hat in the ring first. And it grew from there.
What was it like running for office with all those kids? At a time when I think the expectation was that the woman of the family would be in charge of the kids.
Well, that's true, except I have great kids. and they were out stuffing mailboxes for me, knowing how to do it legally. And I lost my first two elections very closely, and I reminded them, so did Abraham Lincoln. And they learned a lot going through that with me. And then when I was elected on local level, we just went from there. And they were always part of it. My husband, from the day I first put my name on a ballot, on a candidate's ballot, he was totally in support of what I was doing. And he knew it was such a deep interest of mine. So we had a good working agreement.
I've heard from some researchers who look at women in politics, there's a tendency, not universal, but for men who decide to run for office, they think, I'd be really good in this post. And for women, it's often somebody else telling them you'd be really good in this post. It sounds like, though, you might be an exception to that. This sounds like it came more from within.
Yeah, I think it is. I think I was. But I had a lot of encouragement when my husband came home the day I decided to do it, and I told him what I decided to do that day. He looked at me and said, thank God, it's about time. I didn't think you were ever going to do it. And so he was right there with me right from the start.
I think a lot of people, men and women, anybody looks at people running for office, people working in government, and doesn't see their face in that role for one reason or another. Can you give, I don't know, a little of that sixth grade civics lesson to them that might make people who don't think about office, think about running for office, think about it?
Sure. I think what the important thing to do is to realize, who is government? We are government, not somebody else. We are. It's our responsibility. And I think we've continued to see that. I think as a candidate, for example, I felt like I was sitting in the middle of a living room teaching, because people didn't understand the sequencing of elections. They didn't understand when is it partisan, when isn't it partisan. They just have so much to learn. And I being a teacher by my original, let me turn that off.
Sure.
But when they, you know, when I would get going on it, I would realize, wait a minute, I'm teaching them things either they never heard or they forgot. And so there was an awful lot of teaching involved. And I think that's still the case.
Talking to Margaret Farrow, former Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin, a first woman to serve in that post, talking about her career and politics and women, whether they're represented in our politics today. And now let's look at your old stomping grounds, the state legislature. We have a record number of women here in Wisconsin in our state legislature, same in Congress. So that's if you're interested in women in Congress and legislatures, that's the good news. Bad news is still you're talking 1 in 3, 30-ish percent, depending on which one you're looking at. What do you think of the numbers we see today?
Well, I think they're increasing. It seems to be the case, but I also think it's quality, not quantity. And I'm glad to know that the women I'm meeting who are running for office are certainly everybody, you'd want them there. And they're not just doing it for some self-serving reason. And I'm very encouraged by that. I encourage them to do it. I make sure when I talk to candidates, they know what they're getting into. And it works.
In terms of numbers, we saw Democrats leading and still having more women serving in those legislatures. But these record numbers are driven, it looks like, by an increase in the number of Republican women now in this 2021 state legislature. Same with Congress, I believe. As a Republican yourself, do you find that encouraging?
I think it's good. I mean, the partisan side of me comes out where you sit in a large room, in this case, the Assembly, the Senate, wherever you are, and they're counting votes. So you naturally have to look at numbers. You don't get a bill passed unless you get enough votes on your side. I learned that very quickly. I learned how to work with other people, which is what I'm sadly feeling isn't there as much as it used to be. I knew that if I was going to get a bill through, I had to get a strong partner on the other side of the aisle Doris Hansen, who was a state representative when I was also in, in fact, I was upset when she retired because she was older than I was. And I kept thinking, darn, there she goes. But she and I did more bills together. And it was because we knew we had to be able to reach both caucuses. And that's what you learn you have to do, in, especially on the partisan side, where you have to count votes by what letter is behind your name so often.
Why do you, this is, I mean, this is a big topic of conversation in Congress and here in Wisconsin, polarization. From where you're sitting, what happened? Why has it gotten harder, or at least it looks a lot harder, to get that kind of long-term partnership between the person with an R by their name and the person with a D by their name?
Well, I'm not quite sure if I'm going to come up with the most profound answer on that one, but I'll tell you, the important part of that is you have to develop the want to do in your it within you, what we were talking about earlier. And I think you've just got to find the answers. And I really believe that I think it'll balance out. I really do.
One issue I wanted to ask you about, we see, unfortunately, in the news still in 2021, women facing various kinds of harassment when they go into politics and government, a bipartisan problem, apparently. I don't know. Has it gotten worse, or do we just know about it more, do you think?
I think it's the latter. First of all, there's more women doing it. You've already said that. I agree with that. It's true in business. There's more out in the world. And I think that we have to make sure that men realize there's a balance that is needed here. And I think it's going to work out. I'm very positive about that.
So if you, and I assume you talk to sixth graders from time to time yourself still, when you talk to, you know, that girl in sixth grade, what do you say, hoping to encourage them to follow a career in public service?
Well, I often look right in their eyes at the end of any presentation I make and look at all the girls in this case, if I'm speaking specifically on this issue rather than government in general, mm-hmm. and I'll say, you can do what I'm doing here. You've got to find the answers to what government's about. You've got to find why people run, what they do when they win and get in office, and realize that's your responsibility. I once said to a group up in Stevens Point, in a breakfast get-together with, I don't know if it was a key club or what it was, and I said, you know what, the future of our state depends on you. What are you going to do about it? And I mean that. And this kid came up to me afterwards. It looked like he fell out of bed in his dorm room. And I wish I knew where he was now, because he had his eyes so wide. And he said, Senator, I don't know what I was at the time, Senator, Lieutenant Governor. And he said, that was cool. Nobody ever told me that I was the future of the state and I could make things happen. He said, I've got to start really studying. And I thought, oh, my God, I hope I turned a light on for him. And I think that's with parents, and that's what I think, in a way, our internet is doing some of that, because so much more is available now. But, you know, I'm still concerned. We've got to keep feeding the other side of the growth area.
And I wanted to ask, you mentioned you lost your first couple races for office. What do you say to that person who did get that vision, they ran, and they lost?
Well, I just tell him, look at Abraham Lincoln. He lost his first two elections, and he lost more things that he tried to get in leadership in the legislature, both in Springfield, Illinois, and in Washington when he got out there. I mean, you have to have the desire, and you have to know why you're doing it, and then stay committed, especially with that army of committed people right behind you. I mean, when you've got six men, as I had in my family, and they are all bright, intelligent, challenging me to the hilt. I couldn't disappoint them. I couldn't disappoint myself in the desire I had. So you just keep working at it.
Margaret, thanks a lot for taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Well, it was good speaking with you, Rob. Very, very nice. Thank you.
That was Margaret Farrell, longtime member of Wisconsin State Legislature and the first woman to serve as Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll talk more about women in politics, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? If you're a woman, have you run for office? Have you considered it and rejected the idea? If so, why? What would it have taken to put you into throwing your hat into the ring? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about women's representation in politics. This year, women broke records at the federal and state levels. There are now more women serving in Congress and in the Wisconsin state legislature than ever before. But women in legislatures are still far outnumbered by men, who make up about 70% of Congress and the state legislature. Looking at why that is and what happens when there are more women in government. Elisa von Hagel is an associate professor of political science at UW-Superior. Her research focuses on biomedical policy, reproductive rights, the pro-life movement, and the religious right. And she teaches a class on women in politics. You could join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your own experience running for office. Elisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me for this conversation.
Well, we just heard from former Lieutenant Governor Margaret Farrow there, and we have this record-breaking year for women in legislatures. What do you think is driving that trend now?
Well, one thing that she's mentioned that I want to sort of build on is this idea of encouragement, and I think that she is spot on that for, you know, whether it's women, people of color, people of, you know, different ethnic backgrounds or, you know, religious backgrounds, that people we don't typically see in public office, encouragement by party leaders, by family, by colleagues, by whomever, can really serve as a really powerful motivator. And I think, but what's interesting about what we saw with the huge increase in women's representation of this past election cycle was that so many women were, I guess, no longer waiting for that push, that encouragement, that ask, you know, being asked to run for office. And so whether or not that represents a large scale change is obviously yet to be seen. But, you know, as of, you know, based upon the research anyway, that notion or idea of encouragement, it really is central.
Is there a self-sustaining cycle? Maybe if young women grow up seeing women serving these posts, they're more likely to consider it as an option for themselves?
Absolutely. I mean, the notion that a person, an individual, sees themselves as empowered to act politically, whether it's, you know, to vote, to donate, to volunteer, or to run for office, is not solely dependent upon seeing, you know, someone who looks like you in office, but seeing those individuals who look like you that is different than, you know, all the others, you know, that really can serve as an extraordinary motivator or serve as a role model of sorts to allow individuals, whether it's women, younger women or girls, to see themselves as politically efficacious, that they have the right and to be there and to run for office.
If there are more women in office, does it lead to any different policies?
There's been a lot of research on this. We see that there are a lot of the research tends to focus on, you know, issues such as child care or family leave policy. And we see that with the increase of women in office in different, like, local, regional, even state level bodies of government, that there is a measurable, you know, expansion or increase in the of child care access. And so we see that, you know, that's obviously an issue that still to this day is still predominantly addressed or dealt with by women. And so it's an issue that women are perhaps more likely to be cognizant of or thinking about with respect to, you know, their doing their job in office. We also see that it's women that really changed, helped to transform our the way in which help to put pressure on the organizations that govern medical research. And we saw that are really up until the 1990s, sort of the, you know, most medical research, biomedical research was conducted on virtually only white men, whether it's, you know, a new form of aspirin or if it was breast cancer research. All of that was conducted primarily on men's bodies. And so it was women that really brought, you know, attention to the issue and also used a different type of awareness raising and involving of the public that allowed members of Congress to see what, you know, that this was an issue and to address it. So there's so many different ways in which women have these sort of small or even really large scale effects on public policy.
Talking to Lisa von Hagel from UW-Superior, political scientist there, looking at women in politics, growing numbers of women in legislatures in states, including Wisconsin, and in Congress. Lisa, there's a gender gap I see every presidential election. Women lean Democratic in the final vote, usually less so than Republican, vice versa, often for men. Do you see that that kind of gender gap playing out in who's running for office as Democrats versus Republicans?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We see that, I mean, the presence of Democratic women in office hugely outpaces those of, you know, their Republican counterparts. And there's also, again, been so much written on this and so many different ways to look at the issue. But absolutely, we see that there is, you know, despite notable gains at different, you know, here and there, different points in time, we see that, so women in the Republican Party are quite minimal as compared to their Democratic counterparts. And I would say probably more so than the public in general with respect to. Their presence in Congress is even more so diminished than their presence in the general public in terms of ideology.
Now, we have the actual population is roughly 50-50, I think actually a little more, 51-49 or something like that, more women than men. Is there going to be a day, do you think, when we are at a 50-50-ish split in terms of representation in Congress and legislatures?
Well, according to all my students in class, like, just eventually, we'll get there. They're all firm believers that over time it'll happen. And I guess, I don't know, I'm kind of still a little agnostic on the question, but I guess based upon, I know some people have kind of looked at the trends from 1917 to today and have played out or, you know, when we would achieve parity, at least at the federal level in the U.S. Congress. And so many people look to 2108 as this magical date in which it will happen. And again, there's so many different, you know, forces and factors that could shape this. And again, how COVID plays into that, you know, how this affects women's representation in years to come is obviously yet to be seen. But it certainly won't be anytime soon, no doubt. So unfortunately, we will still just hopefully see these gradual increases over time.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Lisa, do you see some of the things that might have been barriers for women going away at all between now and, I don't know, 2108?
In terms of women running for office, I think there are some barriers that are being addressed with respect to presenting themselves as mothers or as women. In the past, it was discouraged as such, and there are differences in the way that the media treats men and women candidates, which is slowly starting to change, and hopefully that continues. But again, we see certain candidates in certain elections or certain races that these stereotypes, these negative stereotypes, really become heightened and can negatively affect not only the candidates themselves, but also potential women who want to run for office and see the way that the media is treating certain individuals because of their gender or their sexuality or whatever. And that no doubt could potentially diminish the number of women who are willing to run for office. So there's positive changes, but yet it's, you know, there's still work. There's definitely still work that needs to be done.
Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Lisa von Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Superior. She joined us for a look at women in the world of politics and government. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, when you move away from your hometown, do you still feel connected to it, and do you want to move back? The author of the new book, Uprooted, looks at the emotions we attach to the places we grow up. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. A new experimental project could create a fleet of high-tech garbage trucks for Earth's orbit. As reported by Insider, there's a big problem with debris in inner space, not quite outer space there. A lot of it in the form of satellites that aren't working anymore and have nowhere to go. The new design would use magnets to lock onto those satellites and then drag them toward Earth's orbit where they'd burn up on reentry. Seems kind of drastic. Plus, this plan would only work on new satellites with built-in pickup magnets, not the ones that are already up there. More important, seeing this story reminded me that on Central Time, we talked about space garbage before it was cool with an engineer who was sounding the alarm about the problem. Looking back in our archives, I saw that we did that in spring of 2014, which led to the further newsflash for me that this show has been on the air since 2014. Actually, looking back, it was summer of 2013 we started. Where'd the time go? Anyway, you can build up a lot of debris in and around a desk in that many years. Maybe we need some kind of magnetic orbital thing where I can just declutter my desk, send it up to space, and let it all burn up on reentry. I think I may have the job of the future. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.